I met my best friend Anne in 1985.
And the Babysitter's Club kept her friendship alive.
Then Emily was born in 1988, and she said,
"Thanks, Aunt Esme, these books are great.
Now we're all grown up and we're living our dreams
as a writer
and a scholar
and an expert on teens.
And we're gonna start again from the very first book
because we're stuck
in Stony Brook."
Welcome to Stuck in Stony Brook, a podcast about the Babysitter's Club. Today we're discussing the next in the portrait collection series, Dawn's book.
Dawn's
the next book.
Book
in the portrait collection series. Next.
No.
Next. Yeah,
I
thought
this one was kind of okay.
I think they're getting better. I think this was much better than Stacy's book or Chris. Who did we read before? Mary Ann's book? I remember now, but I think this is better.
Yeah.
Well, I don't know. I guess so. I wish they were not so, they're all so serious.
Yeah.
I wish they were a little bit more lighthearted. You know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's fair. Yeah.
Yeah. That's fair. I wish their formative memories were like sillier.
Less traumatic.
Yeah.
Why do you guys have such big core memories?
Yeah.
Fair.
I don't know. Every time I read one of these books, I'm like, what are my core memories?
Yeah. What do you think?
I don't know.
Yeah.
Like, I can't really, they're all, my memories are very scattered.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I remember like Halloween costumes.
Mm-hmm.
Would that be your eighth grade project? Would just be like a litany of the Halloween costumes you wore?
Yeah. I mean, the one that really stands out is the jukebox and record one that we wore.
Yeah. I was a jukebox and Anne was a record, and we made
write an entire chapter about that.
Yeah.
And it'd be really boring about sourcing cardboard.
Yeah. So it's good that we're not in the real Babysitter's Club and we didn't have to do this real project for our eighth grade biography.
Right. Yours would be good, though. I feel like yours and Emily's would be good.
Oh, that's very sweet. But I don't know.
I feel like Emily would have like an Aaron chapter.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't know.
Yours would be more similar because you could have a, like, you know, rather than bi-coastal, it's like bi-townal. Like, you would have a bit about your Three Rivers life and a bit about your Visalia life. Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. For sure.
Anne and I would be like, we live near the zoo. Like, there's not much else to say. We like Vicks ice cream. Anyway.
Well, how old was I when I took the train to visit you in college?
You were 10.
Yeah. So that probably would have been in there.
When you by yourself?
Yeah.
Would that happen anymore?
No, absolutely not. But I suggested it to Matt's family that our nephew, when he was 10, come down on the train and visit us. And everyone was horrified by the suggestion. I was like, it's not like you just put him, like you would tell someone on the train would know he's an unaccompanied minor. It's not like he just wanders onto a random train and then like has to figure out himself when to get off. Like, what?
Yeah. Yeah.
No, well, you just ask a stranger to take care of
you. No, you don't
child.
Ask a stranger. Well, yes, a stranger, but a stranger that works for Amtrak. I think that it should happen.
A reliable stranger.
A reliable stranger.
A vetted stranger.
Yeah. Well, but part of it is that kids are less independent, and part of it is also that boys are less independent than girls when they're younger. Like, unfortunately, it's part of the bedrock of society's problems, but we could get into that more on another day.
Yay.
Anyway, did you guys do your one sentence summaries?
Yeah.
Okay, what's yours, Emily?
I went with Dawn learned some lessons about babysitting, but more importantly, about herself.
Oh, that's really nice. That could be on the back of the book.
That could be on the back of the book.
How about you, Anne?
Mine is Dawn was a judgmental child.
Yeah, for real.
That's why she's so close to Mary Ann later.
Yeah,
exactly. She becomes a lot less judgmental, though. She learns a lesson about it.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Mine was Dawn shares her life story while Anne and Jean Betancourt start to figure out this portrait collection format. I think they're starting to figure it out. The kinks. Yeah, it's just like a little bit. It's a little more. It's still episodic essays, but it's a little bit more cohesive, I feel like, than the previous ones.
Yeah, I agree.
Yeah.
You agree?
Cool.
I don't agree at all.
Oh, wow. Whew. I guess we have to break up.
Yeah, I guess the podcast is over, you guys. Sorry.
Okay, wait, you guys. We should probably back up and tell you about the members of the podcast. I'm Annie Chikawa, a freelance writer. I'm a mischievous pragmatist with a sweet tooth.
I'm Emily Crandall, a feminist scholar. I'm a total individual, and I like health food.
And I'm Esme Schaller, an adolescent psychologist. I'm kind of bossy, but I have a big heart. If you want to learn more about us and how we know each other, please check out our prologue episode. Also, rate and review us. It really helps people find the podcast. If you have any questions, comments, or commentary about anything BSC related, you can drop us a line at stuckinstonybrook@gmail.com. You can also support us on Patreon at patreon.com/stuckinstonybrook. And we have 3 new patrons to thank to give a pizza toast to. They are, yeah, woohoo. They are Muriel Keck, Elizabeth Brown, and Mary Ellen.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks, guys. Pizza toast.
Toast. I did think it was funny that Anne chose like a really small lull after we joke about breaking up to be like, well, I guess we should introduce ourselves.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Might as well.
I was kind of like, do we talk about this more or do I just go?
You know what I like about the portrait collection? I like that there's no chapter 2.
Oh, that's true.
Oh, that's true. Yeah.
Yeah. Who would pick up this book if they didn't know something about the Babysitter's Club? They would not bother. So,
but also to like some, I think, to tease out something that several of our guests have hinted at. Like, I think that you can read some of these books without all of the context and the 1,000 characters that exist in the world. And I think you get from this book, you get enough to follow along. I think you could read this as a standalone.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's my hot take.
Well, especially.
Yeah, I wonder if we could erase our memories and only read.
Ooh, that'd be fun.
Who would we like the most so far?
We can get the severance procedure, but only for reading the Portrait Collections books.
Yeah.
It's like our 4th or 5th severance reference in like 2 or 3 episodes.
Well, it's relevant. Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. The work is interesting and important. No, mysterious and important. Yeah. Yeah. You're saying based on the ones. So it was Claudia's book that we read so far, Stacey and Claudia's. And then this one, who would we like more? Probably Claudia.
Claudia.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But it's kind of like Stacey's book is not that good. And we really like Stacey. I think Dawn's book makes her more likable than Stacey. And I don't think that that's true in the series overall.
Right. Yeah, that's but what we're not. Asking.
We don't know the series.
Yeah. Right.
Oh. We only know these books.
Right.
We've been severed.
Severance procedure, Esme.
Hello.
All right. I've probably been severed from even reading this last week. So, Anne, why don't you tell us a little bit about the
plot? Oh, boy. Okay. So, Dawn is back in Palo City and in 8th grade at her school and has to also write a memoir because it's something all 8th graders seem to have to do.
Yes. National conspiracy.
Right. So, okay. Let's go through all of her core memories. Okay. One is her best friend, Sunny, and Sunny's family moving in.
There's one before that, right?
Was there one before that?
It's like a non-memory memory of like her getting a brother, basically, right? Like it starts with Dawn's mom being like pregnant with her.
Oh, right.
And then
right,
she has to learn how to not be the center of attention.
Right. Okay. Core memory one. Core memory two is Sunny moving in with her hippie family. Mm-hmm. And Dawn is just like, who the hell are these weirdos? They like, and is embarrassed.
Super embarrassed. Yeah.
Which is really strange to me since
she's only 6. Yeah.
Yeah. She's only like, I'm like, that's like, weird tie dye. Like, what? Yeah.
I didn't think it was very pretty.
Yeah.
And
then these might go out of order. They go away to San Francisco to celebrate her grandparents' 50th wedding anniversary. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And that was sort of a weird chapter because it was kind of about how her grandparents seem not to like each other, but then they really love each other.
Yeah. I think it's supposed to like lay the groundwork for her surprise at her parents' divorce.
Yeah. I have some thoughts about it. We'll get into it.
Okay. Another one is when she's, I'm sure I skipped a lot here, but she's in Stony Brook now and she babysits.
It's interesting. It's interesting. Psychologically interesting what you skipped.
Oh, the fire.
Yeah.
Yes.
I'm sure there's something else that happened, but then she moves to Stony Brook.
Right. So Dawn's biggest fear is her house burning down. Mm-hmm. And when she's babysitting, who is she? Is it Daffodil?
Yeah, Clover and Daffodil.
There's a kitchen fire. Is that correct? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And she has to she has to usher them out. But thankfully, Dawn is prepared because she has already gone over the emergency steps of what to do if there is a house fire.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Mm-hmm.
But, you know, it was only their kitchen. They can just file an insurance claim for that. And, you know, it's all good. Still,
they don't have to move.
They don't have to move or anything.
Well, the mom, over in Daffodil.
The mom's a weaver artist.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And she's like, are my things safe? And everything's safe because Dawn closed the door.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Good thing she, nothing has to be remediated, apparently. Yeah. Cool. Good for them. Great. No rubble to sift through.
Ugh.
Okay, that got dark. Sorry.
No one sad lawn creature left.
Oh, yeah. Carapia coming back. I just planted a lawn alternative at my house, listeners, that Anne had planted at her old house. And on Anne's advice, because here in California we need to save water, and so I'm tending to it and trying to get it to grow, but it is growing back at Anne's pile of rubble
that
used to be her house. So it's strong,
still living.
I've
it's
made
very
a good
strong
decision.
Like no it's water living. Nothing and it's still growing back. It's very impressive.
It is impressive.
It's called Carapia, anyway, if anyone's interested.
Yeah, it's Japanese. It's Japanese. Yeah. She would have told you that if I didn't. So it's Japanese.
It's like a brand name ground covering.
Yeah.
Love that.
That's right.
I recommend. Yeah.
Okay. Is that the chapter also where her parents are getting divorced?
No, it happens after that.
Okay.
So it she doesn't say a lot about it. It's just and then my parents got to, it's like they were fighting. It was not fun. I think it's a little bit in the background because it's like, I was focused on this other thing.
Right. It is that chapter.
Yeah.
They're fighting a lot. And then in the next chapter, they're divorced.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And then she moves to Stony Brook and she fucks up at the Lasers' house. And then that's it, basically.
Mm-hmm.
And she's back in California.
Yeah. Cool.
Yep.
So what did we, it was kind of a little serious, as we mentioned before.
Mm-hmm.
But. Yeah. You know.
I thought it was well written, though.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I thought each of the stories were well told.
Yeah. I feel like there's an opportunity maybe for the portrait collections to even go darker.
Interesting. So revising your initial assessment.
You know how some YA books are really dark? And it's what's that? Oh, yeah. Maggie Diary 2. I don't know what that is. What is
California
that?
Diaries?
Oh, that's California Diaries.
Yeah,
I've never read one. I've never read one California Diary book. So.
Weight 103 pounds, goal 90 pounds.
Oh,
yeah.
Shit.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, it's brutal.
Yeah.
I'm kind of excited for you to read one. You're going to be now we're cooking.
Yeah.
Wait, is Maggie the shy one? Or is Maggie one of Dawn's?
Yeah, Maggie's the one whose dad is a producer, right?
Oh, okay, yeah. Who looks cool and has funky hair? Okay,
yeah,
that makes sense. She's around all the Hollywood people.
Mm-hmm. Yep,
she feels like she needs to be really thin.
Yep, that's a good 90s explanation for why people have an eating disorder.
she's using health food as a cover for her eating disorder.
Okay, so back to Dawn's book.
Oh, yeah. Sorry.
Could have been darker. Emily, what'd you think? What's in your corner?
Not a ton. There were just some funny, like, kid forming ideas about gender things that were really funny to me. So, like, but kind of pulling in opposite directions. So Dawn's, like, very careful to narrate that she preferred trucks and blocks, not dolls or whatever, I think, right? Is it dolls? What's the girly? Yeah, dolls. And she talks a lot about, like, the Madeline books, which I think are really funny because those are super girly, but, like, maybe they get a pass on, like, dolls or Barbies or whatever because it's, like, in Paris and it's, like, an interesting story or something. But I also thought the through line where she sets up, like, I loved Madeline as a kid, and then that's, like, one of the things that she connects with later, the babysitting charge back in Stony Brook, right? It's like, oh, I loved the Madeline books too. I was like, that's a really funny kind of tenuous thread there. Like, what literary function is that serving? Because she doesn't actually end up establishing much of a bond with that kid. She kind of, like, messes it up, and the thing that she gets, like, essentially gets the BSC fired for is, like, telling her something she shouldn't have told her. But I'm like, what is the Madeline, like, thread there? Do you know what I mean? Like,
yeah, I just took it as, like, a demonstration of Dawn being good at connecting with children.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you know, what can you connect with the kid in front of you as opposed to, like, a greater.
Yeah, it's just a really specific, like seed to plant three chapters prior and then, like, follow up on it. But I guess that's why this is, like, slightly better than the Stacey book, right? At least there were those little, like, nuggets or something.
There were follow ups.
Like, yeah. 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 The other funny, like, thing in the litany of judgments that she has about the Winslows is she's especially horrified when Sonny's father, like, so they get out of their, like, weird car covered in, like, random colors and flowers. And then they're wearing long nightgown looking dresses. And Dawn's never seen anyone wear long dresses before, unless they're at a formal event, which I'm like, what is that possible? And then they're, like, you know, frolicking and dancing and spinning in circles. And then the father joins and Dawn is, like, absolutely horrified, which I think is so funny because she just talked about how, like, she didn't, you know, she preferred, like, boy coded toys to girl coded toys. Mm-hmm. So I'm like, which is it?
Yeah, that's a great point. That was the bridge too far for her. She's like, oh, this guy.
Yeah. But I'm like, what's horrifying about it? Is it that, like, he's breaking a gender rule about, like, how fathers should act, or is it, like, just the hippiness of it all is, like, a horror? And why I'm, like, shocked that that would be so, like, something she'd never seen before.
Well, I was trying to figure out what year this is supposed to be, right? Because if it's supposed to be when they were actually born for the 1986 books, we're only in 1980. And I don't think Dawn in 1980 in Southern California would be shocked by seeing hippies.
Right. That's what I mean.
But it's 1995 now when this book is coming out. And if it's 1995 when the book's coming out, it has her born in 82. And then it's 88 when this is happening. It's at the end of the Reagan era. Greed is good. We're at the mall. It would have seemed really weird. And I remember as a 10-year-old when my mom wore, like, palazzo pants to school, everybody called them bell bottoms and thought it was fucking hilarious. And, like, anything that, like, smacked of anything a little bit hippie was deeply made fun of in the mid to late 80s.
Really? I feel like, I mean, I guess that was true, but this is, like, my portrait story. Yeah. But, like, I guess that was true in Visalia, but that was definitely not true in Three Rivers. Like,
yeah, but Three Rivers is, like, back to the land. Like,
yeah, like, the Winslows would have loved it there.
Sourdough, like, yeah, you know, trad wives before we had trad wives, like,
yeah, know. true.
Also,
self-reliance, that's Three Rivers. That's not, you know, think about Visalia. Like, Palo City is clearly more like Visalia or Sacramento than it is like Three Rivers.
Right.
It's a suburb.
Yeah.
But Palo City is like Orange County.
Yeah, exactly.
Which is
so Orange County
suburb-y.
In 88, I feel like they would have, that would have been the reaction, but not in 1980, because I think, like, a lot of the beachside communities in Orange County in the, like, late 70s were more hippie.
Okay, another conspiracy theory. Do we think Anna Martin has also never been to Oregon?
Probably. Say more.
I just mean, like, on this logic that it's sort of anachronistic for, like, hippies to be living in Southern California. Is it also anachronistic for them to be, like, living in Oregon? Or is it just, like, everyone in Oregon's a hip, like, that trope that, like, everyone in Oregon is, like, a weirdo hippie? Like, do you know what I mean? Like, is it accurate in the 80s that a hippie family would leave Oregon and move to Southern California? Or is it just a stereotype about people from Oregon in general?
I have no idea. Anne, do you have any thoughts on that?
No.
Fine. I'm thinking maybe she's never been.
I think that's fair.
I thought it was, like, really, it makes more sense when we get to the context in which Don meets the Winslows, but I thought it was a really interesting detail in the opening chapter, which is in the present after she's moved back to Palo City, that she flags that Mrs. Winslow makes her own yogurt. Mm-hmm. I was like, that's such a specific, like, thing to make at home that not everyone, even people who do things at home like pickle or grow their own vegetables, would do. It's like more, it's a different kind of, like, do it yourself. I feel like it's a different magnitude of do-it-yourself. Don't you think?
I think it comes and goes. I know a lot of people that make their own yogurt, but I do live in Berkeley, California.
Right.
So I have and I work in San Francisco. So I feel like I have a biased sample for that. But I do, I agree with you that it's, like, a separate thread. But I feel like a lot of the people I know, that the yogurt is the only one they do, because they're like, it's so easy. You can just do it in the slow cooker or whatever, and it's cheaper and it's tastier, versus, like, I'm not going to mess with all those other things.
Should, like, I make my own yogurt? Pickles.
You probably should make your own yogurt. For reals. I'm surprised Micah doesn't do it, actually.
Why? Yeah. See, this is fascinating to me, because I don't think I know anyone who makes their own yogurt.
I mean, I don't do it because for me, I have to really like the food to bother making it myself, and like, yogurt's fine, but I'm like, the store yogurt's fine.
We eat a lot of yogurt.
Yeah, they eat a lot of yogurt, and Micah likes to homebrew, so he's, like, interested in fermentation and that kind of stuff. Yes. So, and he, like, likes to do, like, super craft cocktails and things like that, and he eats a lot of yogurt. He likes smoothies. He likes parfaits. So, like, it would make sense that Micah would make yogurt.
It would, yeah. It's great. I think it's like, yeah, I mean.
Should get him for his birthday tomorrow.
Yeah. Yeah. Should I send him a yogurt cake?
Class.
Yeah, class.
He actually did get his brother, like, a fermentation kit for his brother. So he's
See, that's what I'm saying. He likes fermentation. All right.
I also thought, Dawn's judgment about her grandparents' relationship was really weird to me.
Oh, yeah. I'm ready. I'm ready to talk.
You're
about
ready for that?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, maybe I'll just say that I thought it was odd. And then, like, punt it to you, because I didn't have anything, like, thoughtful to say about it. It just sort of, like, struck me as odd.
Mm-hmm. Fair. Do you have anything else on your list, or are you punting it to me now?
Nothing really that interesting.
Oh, well, that makes me want to know what it is, but I'll have to wait. Yeah. So that was one of the main things that I was thinking about, was, like, kids' viewpoints of adult romantic relationships. And so I, you know, because she's only 10 on the San Francisco trip. And I thought the trip was weirder than the grandparent stuff, because they take this trip, like, their family of four, and they meet Granny and Pop-Pop there ostensibly to celebrate them, but they do a bunch of things apart the whole time. And sometimes it's, like, Dawn and Grammy and Mom, and then Jeff and Pop-Pop and Dad, but they, like, don't. I'm like, there's only six of you. Why don't you compromise and do stuff together? Like, aren't you there to spend time together? And if your grandparents have been married for 50 years, they're not going to be around forever either. Like, it's a little bit weird to me.
That part didn't seem so weird, because it just seemed like it was part of their dynamic. Like, their relationship was cute. They, like, tease each other, and they're like, oh, you like that silly thing, you weird old bird.
I like this
silly thing. And that's like an expression of their, like, love language, to be like, you do your thing, I'll do mine, or something.
Yeah.
That's how I read it.
Yeah, that's fair. That's fair. So, yeah, I think, you know, 10-year-olds don't know a lot about adults and romantic relationships. And so it seemed right to me that Dawn would have kind of a simplistic idea of what it means to be in love and to care about each other. And in fact, to me, that sort of signals part of the challenges that may face Jack and Sharon, if they have more of like a surfacey connection over all this time, like if the way Dawn knows that they're good is that they just seem really sweet to each other all the time.
Holding hands.
Yeah. Is anyone going to explain what Ann just did?
Oh, I just hit the sexy gesture.
The sexy gesture. Pointer finger through a circle in the other hand. Yeah.
Yeah.
But you know, right, like she's like, my parents are really nice to each other and Granny and Pop-Pop are mean, like basically.
But they're not mean.
They're not mean.
They're funny.
But to a 10-year-old, they might seem mean, right? Whereas it just seems like the Schaefers are still happy at this point. She's made very clear that they're happy, but that they would need, you know, these like overt displays of being kind to each other consistently for that to mean that the relationship is good. Like that's all Dawn knows is like, if you're nice, it means the relationship is good.
Right.
Whereas it had me thinking about the, you know, John Gottman, the famous psychologist at University of Washington who studied a lot about different types of marriages. He's the one who says like, if you give him, you know, 10 minutes with a couple, he can predict with 90% accuracy if they'll stay together or if they'll eventually get divorced based on these like conversational prompts he gives them. And he's classified different couple styles of how people tend to deal with disagreements and arguments and things like that. And I think Granny and Pop-Pop are what is the very short description of is what he calls volatile, which they have intense, passionate relationships with frequent heated arguments, but also strong affection and makeup periods. So this idea that they have lots of, you know, they have all these little disagreements, they make fun of each other a lot, but then he's always on time when he says he's going to meet her and he's never been late before. And all of those super consistent things that Granny mentions. Whereas I think, you know, Jack and Sharon might be conflict avoiders. So they, you know, they spend a lot of time talking about what's good about their relationship and that they maintain a lot more positives in their interactions with each other. But if you do that too much and you don't ever deal with the conflict, that can have a really hard time over time. Mm-hmm. Right.
So wouldn't Sharon like model her relationship after her parents?
No, not necessarily. No? I mean, I don't know. Do you feel like you model your relationship after your parents?
No, but I feel like I have certain habits or not habits, learned behaviors. Mm-hmm. That are just maybe they don't even have to do with being in a romantic relationship, but just overall, like how you express your emotions or your affection and things like that.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. It can be, but people also can go the opposite, right? Mm-hmm. It really depends on what the models are and what you think about it and the effect it had on you, all that kind of stuff. But I would think that. And it's, you know, it's also depends on your partner, right? Like you can approach something and your partner can have a totally different approach. Mm-hmm. And it may that, you know, the mix might be different than you think it will be. Right.
Right.
So yeah. So both conflict avoiders and volatile couples have, you know, a big thing in the Gottman's research is this idea of positive to negative interactions and that you're really supposed to, it's the healthiest relationships have 5-1, like 5 positive interactions for every 1 negative interaction. And that's what it takes to like feed into a good relationship over time. And that's true for both the conflict avoiders and the volatile couples. So there's the conflict avoiders tend to have a little bit more boundaries and separate lives. So they could also be that as well. It's a blend of independence and interdependence. But the volatile couples seem to love to debate and argue, but they're not like actively mean, right? So like you said, Emily, they tease each other, but there's not contempt there. They're not mean to each other. And they sort of enjoy arguing. So it was interesting. Whereas there's other types that are, you know, not as, you know, there's like hostile couples and hostile detached couples. And you know, it's like, what, you know, when did the Schaeffers so change and when did they shift? Yeah, it is bleak. So that's what they—that's what they had me thinking about. And then the other part that jumped out to me was Dawn's fear of fire. And I feel like, did this come up in another book? I feel like we talked about this a long time ago, like early in the series. There was a kid who was obsessed with fire safety.
I don't remember.
I think it's a very common thing. Mm. Yeah, I remember talking about it because I was—that was true for me. And I got really, really scared when the firefighters came to my preschool and talked about, like, stop, drop, and roll and having an escape plan, because we didn't have an escape plan in my house. And I was like, we need an escape plan. And,
well, yeah, that house would have been a fire death trap.
Yep. So I just lived in it terrified for the rest of my life.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I think it's a very common childhood fear, and it's something that a lot of people don't prepare for enough. And so it makes sense to get kids involved in it, but often kids get like over scared and don't manage it as well as Dawn did. I think Dawn, you know, was like, if I can be prepared and I can know what I need to do, then things will be better, which is good. Hmm. And then she got a huge boost of confidence from actually helping Clover and Daffodil's family.
Yeah.
So were you guys afraid of fire when you were kids?
No.
No.
Yeah.
Oh, wow. I do have a memory of, like, when the firefighters would come to our school, and it was like, am I making this up? Or did we, like, have to, did they drive a school bus onto the playground and we had to, like.
We did that.
And we had to, like.
A drill exit, of, like, how to get out of the bus.
How to get out of the bus. Or those two separate things?
Those are two separate things.
Okay. I remember the bus thing was really exciting to me.
Yeah. They drove a fire truck onto the school grounds and showed us all the different parts and showed us how the hose works and stuff. But then they also drove a bus on and we had to practice evacuating the bus. Okay.
Both of those things were very exciting to me.
Yeah. Yeah. Sure. Yeah. Like, just exciting. You weren't scared.
Yeah, I wasn't scared. I thought jumping out of the bus was really exciting.
Oh, I was totally
scared.
Well,
you're like Jeff. Like, let me go practice jumping out the window with my eyes closed right now.
Yeah. No, I was terrified of jumping out of the bus and that I would mess it up and I wouldn't do it well and that it wouldn't work and I would get stuck on the bus and engulfed in flames. Like, it was not exciting to me.
Oh, jeez.
Yeah.
Jesus.
Yeah.
I will say, I think that Jeff was really well rendered in this book. Like, you get a sense of him as like a personality and like as age appropriately different in age from Dawn, which I feel like sometimes in Dawn books, his gap with Dawn either seems too big or too small, you know?
Yeah.
In terms of like how they interact and his maturity and stuff like that.
Yeah. I like that he brought his Game Boy with him.
Yeah.
He like hit it.
Yeah. It's like, so, okay, if your house was on fire, like, would you actually just leave without grabbing anything?
How much fire?
I don't know. It's like smoke. It's like, you got to get out of there. The fire is like, you wake up in the middle of the night and your fire alarm is going off and you don't know where the fire has started, but there was smoke in your room.
I would probably leave.
Yeah.
Okay.
I mean, I would have to get my kids.
Well, yeah.
So that's what I would be focusing on getting.
Non-alive things I'm talking about.
Yeah.
Non.
No, unless there was something that happened to be right next to me.
What about Harold?
Yeah, well, he would already be gone. I feel like animals, like, don't you think that Ripley would get the hell out of there? Like,
this is a really dumb cat. I don't know.
Okay.
So Micah's sister in one of their apartments, there was a fire in their neighboring apartment and like it like seeped over into, so they had it was like basically like burned.
Yeah.
And they couldn't find their cat for a long time. And they went back and like the cat was like under a burnt bed.
Oh, Jesus.
So, I mean, that's great. Miss Milk survived, but like it's like, you know, in New York, it's like cats are like, they're not like indoor outdoor cats.
Cats are stuck.
They're just stuck.
I think anyway, Harold would already be finding us quickly because dogs are scaredy cats, ironically.
That's true. Yeah, it's true. Okay. Well,
Anne,
what's in your corner, Anne?
In my corner. Okay. So in my corner, I want to talk about waterbeds. Because
I was hoping you were going to say that.
Because yeah. Sunny's hippie parents have a waterbed. Yeah. And that was like a big signifier. I was like, whoa. I mean, growing up, my aunt and uncle had a waterbed. And I was like, it was like the most fascinating thing to me. And they never let me on it. And when I would go over there, I would just like look at it. And just be like, whoa, that's so cool. It's a waterbed.
Aunt Mill had a waterbed, my older sister.
Mm-hmm.
Do you remember her having a waterbed, or was it already gone by the time you were little, Emily?
I don't know. I remember a waterbed in someone's house. I don't know whose house. It could have been like a friend of my parents or parents of a friend.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
Well, I will say that at one time, I think the peak was 1987.
Okay.
That... it was like 1 out of 5 mattresses purchased was a waterbed.
That's crazy.
Yeah.
That's wild.
In all of the United States?
Yeah. Domestically. Yes.
Wow.
Isn't that crazy? That's a lot of waterbeds.
That's insane. That's an insane stat. 1 in 5?
Yeah.
I was not prepared for you to say that.
That like broke my brain. I can't go on.
Right? Isn't that seriously crazy? So when I read that stat, I was like, well, I guess it's not so exotic that my aunt and uncle had one, because
it
a lot of people had
them.
Exotic.
It feels like just like you knew one person that had it, one or two.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, totally. But I was like, wow, 1 in 5. Okay. So waterbeds were actually thought of and prototyped in 1833.
What?
So, yeah. It was a guy, his name was Neil Arnott, and he developed a hydrostatic bed to prevent bed sores in patients. Yeah. So I was like, oh, okay. And weirdly, okay, there's a company that sells like water beds for cows now. Apparently it's a thing. So like, because like cows get sores just like laying so much like on the hay. So there's like a whole industry of like water beds for cows.
Emily, what is happening right now on our podcast?
I don't know, but I was really. Yeah. So it's called, okay, it's dccwaterbeds.com. And it says literally water beds for dairy cow comfort.
Wow. Dairy cow comfort.
It says DCC waterbeds offer unparalleled consistency every time she lays down, floating the pressure points and stimulating circulation.
That's so
research
weird.
Shows that our waterbeds perform on par with sand bedding in terms of, I don't know. It goes on. But basically, it's like, I didn't even know that cows like got sores from laying down so much, but also that they have waterbeds for them. I don't, it's, yeah. So that's weird. Anyway. But the modern waterbed was created by a guy named Charles Hall, who was a student at San Francisco State University.
Hmm.
Go Gators.
And he created it in 1968. So he like experimented with other, like, it was kind of, I think, with other things, like he even put like Jell-O in it, and like he added things like cornstarch to the water and stuff. But then in the end, it was just like water.
Emily's very upset.
Why? Is this like, I know what I'll invent next.
I know.
The best mattress full of water that there's ever been.
Right.
Like, why?
Yeah. I don't know. But so what made water beds actually being able to be manufactured was like vinyl, because it was like strong enough and could prevent leakage and everything. So anyway, so then it became a thing. And like, I think just like the era of like counterculture 60s,
mm-hmm,
and all that, you know, going in the 70s, just it was like, as they say, a perfect storm for the waterbed to gain popularity. So like, you know, like Hugh Hefner, obviously they had a connection with sex. It was, mm-hmm, a big thing with like, oh yeah, it's like the swinging singles bed. And like they apparently, the waterbed display in Bloomingdale's in New York was like, for a while, it was like a place where people would just go and hang out.
Ew.
Yeah, it was a popular singles meeting place. And this is from a Time article from 1971. That's
hilarious.
Yeah. So waterbeds aren't popular anymore. And most of the reasons is that we have better beds now. And also they were very impractical. Like, you had to put, like, the frame for it was, like, really heavy. Uh-huh. And it was, like, wood to hold it in place. So it was, like, really heavy in wood. And then you had to, like, connect a hose from, like, the bathroom faucet to your bed.
Do you have to empty it when you move? How do you do that?
Oh, yeah. I guess so. And I guess you had to put you put a little bit of Clorox in with the water so it wouldn't, like, grow.
Get moldy.
Moldy and stuff.
Ew.
But also apparently you had to, like, because it's water, it was cold, so like if you wanted it to be like your body temperature, you had to actually have a heating pad on top.
Uh-huh.
Which was this kind of, so then it took electricity and blah blah blah, so it was just kind of a pain, and it is kind of went out of fashion.
That's crazy,
right? But from this Time article from 1971, there were some funny advertising lines from companies that sold them.
Good.
So, okay. Two things are better on a waterbed. One of them is sleep.
Whoa.
Yeah.
That is suggestive. Wow.
Okay. Here's another one. Live and love in liquid luxury.
Ew.
She'll admire you for your car. She'll respect you for your position, but she'll love you for your waterbed.
That's so weird.
It's so weird, but like some people said, like it even helped women like have orgasms.
Yeah, I could see how that would be prescribed by the advertisement.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. So yeah. But that's at one so time they're very popular, but now no one really wants them because they're a pain in ass.
Okay, but do they even still make them? That's what I wanted.
Yes, they do. I think you can still buy a waterbed. I believe if you go on Amazon, you could probably find one.
That's crazy. But I bet it's really bad. I bet it's like a Temu waterbed. Like,
oh geez, yeah, it probably is.
Really funny.
But yeah, it makes me curious to wonder like how many people now still are just like diehard waterbed. Like there was an article on apartment therapy about it, and I read some of the comments, and it seemed like a lot of people were like, "Oh, like I slept on a waterbed growing up," and they say it's actually very comfortable because it does feel like for your joints, it does feel like weightless a little bit.
Uh-huh. Like,
there's a whole Reddit community of people.
See, I knew it.
Yeah. A subreddit for waterbed owners and enthusiasts. There's 203 members.
Oh, that's not very many.
It's not very many.
Here's some. Does anyone add salt to the water?
Wow. What?
Oh, my God. Wait. Hi there. I got 3 waterbeds, one from Amazon, another from an online distributor, and another from in-store. All 3 had a plastic smell after I filled them and my heater warmed them up. The one online and from Amazon also had dirt smell that transferred to the sheets. Any idea what that might be and how I could remedy it? Like, don't get a waterbed? Wow. I can't wait to spend the rest of my day looking at this.
Yeah.
Thanks, Anne.
Yeah, you're welcome.
I just, so it can be good for your back, but just practically speaking, I remember the sensation of sitting on Mill's waterbed as a kid, and that it's like moving constantly. Like, water moves, which I understand for sex might be appealing, but when you're trying to sleep, like if you roll over, then it's like, I feel like you would get motion sick. I feel like I would get motion sick. Cause it's not like it stays still. Like, it doesn't just contour the way like foam does, right? Like, it, then there's like a, you know, when you move water,
well,
you move
also,
water.
The
whole bed moves some.
If the person sleeping next to you like turns over,
yeah,
like wouldn't you just be like,
yes, you would.
Wave?
Yes.
Yeah.
Impractical. I guess that's why the popularity.
I wonder if there's like, if we go on Airbnb or something, we could find places that have water beds and then we could go there.
Yes.
Do that on our podcast retreat.
I'm super into that idea.
Okay, we'll do some research after.
Yeah.
And then okay.
I already
this,
found
this
one.
Person recommends a brand called or a type that's California King 80% waveless.
Oh.
Let's see.
How do they do that? Oh, you know what? Okay, I actually read about this. It's like they've made it so there's like, instead of one big water reservoir, it's like they've divided it into like
sections. Oh, it's like tubes. Yeah.
Yeah, it's like tubes.
Okay.
Interesting.
Yeah.
But then I feel like you're not getting like the regular mattress.
Yeah. Then it's like you're not getting the experience of the water bed.
Yeah. Okay. You can definitely search by water beds. You can definitely search by water beds on Airbnb.
Oh, what's anything appealing? This,
the first one that comes up, the place is called Hot Tub Time Capsule with Waterbed and Jukebox.
Yes. Where is it?
It's in Middle Grove, New York.
Where's that? Is that upstate?
No, I'm assuming generally. It's upstate.
Yeah, upstate. It's north of New York City. Yeah.
Yeah.
Let's okay. Wow. Give us another one.
Yeah, it's near Saratoga Springs.
Okay.
Yeah.
Desert of Zen waterbed room by Lake Powell. Calm okay. and large room with waterbed in well located Hood, Belgium. Voorst, Belgium.
Belgium.
Let's go there.
Yeah.
So in Belgium. Okay.
Maybe I feel like we're just reading the internet now, but all of us are.
Yes. Yeah. Sorry, listeners.
Okay.
Sorry, and listeners.
Okay. My last nugget was that they talk about the theme to Sesame Street.
Oh, yeah.
So shout out to Joe Raposo.
Joe Raposo is the greatest of all time.
Yes. And he also wrote Being Green.
Mm hmm.
C is for cookie.
Yes.
And sing.
Classic.
Yes.
Wow.
He's
shout out indeed.
Yeah.
He's amazing. I think he also wrote the song when they say a giant panda and it just shows footage of a panda and it's like da 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 da.
He did a lot of stuff.
Yeah.
It's amazing. Oh, yeah. But he, you know.
Yeah.
He died.
He did.
But he was old. Actually, no, he was very young.
He died tragically.
He was only 51.
Yeah, it was not good.
Oh, that's sad.
He is very missed. But we'll toast him at our when we get our waterbed. We'll think fondly of Joe Raposo. Was there candy in this book? And not really, right? Because
no, there was no candy. Yeah.
I did say, though, can we give a shout out? Since it's the snack portion, to Mrs. Winslow's yogurt and herb dip with snow peas and cherry tomatoes.
Yeah, that sounds
yes,
good.
Yes, please.
Yeah.
I wanted to eat that a great deal.
Wait, does that mean you dip the snow peas in it? Or is the snow peas are in the... Okay, okay.
No, you dip the snow peas and the cherry tomatoes in the yogurt herb dip.
Oh, okay, okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, I would eat that.
Yum, right? Sounds good. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. With your homemade yogurt, it's going to be amazing.
Yeah.
So only tally in this book, not surprisingly, based on what we were just talking about, health food was the only one that was mentioned.
Interesting.
But definitely interesting. Still there. Yep.
There weren't a lot of funny lines in this book, I feel.
No.
Yeah, I was thinking the same thing.
I have one, but it's not really funny. I just think it represents Donwell.
Mm-hmm.
I'll tie-dye some other time.
That's good. That's good. I like that. That's a good title, too.
That's a very good title. Yeah. The only one I wrote down was Kelp Soup, my favorite.
that's also good.
But I'll tie-dye some other time is really good, I think.
Yeah, I think that's
okay. Let's do it.
Yeah. Okay. What should we pizza toast to? Oh, go ahead.
Water beds?
We talked a lot about water beds.
Yeah, I don't want to waste our pizza toast on that. I feel like we went a little bit above and beyond with the water beds, even though I was into it. We didn't really talk enough about Sunny's pluckiness in the we talked about her first coming, but the thing that solidifies her for Dawn is when they're in the department store Bambergers and the lights go out and their moms get stuck in the elevator.
Sunny knows Morse code
and can communicate with
the
moms.
I forgot we did not even talk about that.
Yeah. And just like keeps her head, uses like a toy clown as a flashlight. Like adults around her are impressed, knows to ask the adults for the parents, all this kind of stuff. And Dawn's like, okay, this girl knows what's up. I gotta give her another chance.
So you're saying you want a pizza toast to Morse code?
I want a pizza toast to the power outage at Bamberger's. It was really sweet. I really liked that chapter. I thought it was really good and interesting.
Can we pizza toast to it in Morse code? Should I try?
Can you? I cannot.
Yeah, hang on.
While that's really good Foley, watch, you just did Morse code for like, fuck you, listeners. Like, it's like the equivalent of a Japanese character as a tattoo. Like,
yeah. I love it.
No, just poo poo pee pee.
All right. So, pizza toast to Morse code?
Yeah.
Okay. To Morse code.
To Morse code, saving the day. This episode of Stuck in Stony Brook is now adjourned.
Thank you to Anna and Martin for everything. Stuck in Stony Brook is edited by Emily Crandall. Theme song written and recorded by Gary Schaller, performed by the band Kid Kit. You can follow us on Instagram at Stuck in Stony Brook, or find us on our website, stuckinstonybrook.com. Need some books that we mentioned? Buy them from our bookshop and support both a local independent bookstore and your favorite series literature analysis podcast. Find us at bookshop.org/shop/stuckinstonybrook. Lastly, if you're feeling dibbly generous and you want to rate and review us on Apple Podcasts, that would be super helpful. You're the best friends a girl could ask for.